We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for this program. Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. Well, it certainly seems that America's two major political parties agree on very little these days. One thing they do seem to agree on, the fact that the U.S. government spends more money than it takes in. Of course, they disagree on what to do about that. This morning in this hour, we'll try to talk a little bit about how it is and why it is that deficits and debt have become central issues in today's politics, and perhaps ask some basic questions like this one. Are deficits really always bad? And could it in fact be that this whole business of deficit and debt has been somewhat blown out of proportion? In this hour of the show, we will review the current debate on the problem of government living beyond its means and how we might address that. And our guest for the program is Neil Buchanan. He is professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. He teaches in a number of areas, including tax policy and law and economics, and does research on things like long-term tax and spending patterns of the government, focusing on deficits, on the national debt, and also issues like healthcare costs and Social Security. He's also involved in a long-term research project that asks how current policy choices should be shaped by concerns for the interests of future generations. So we'll touch on a number of these things this morning. And of course, as always, questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome now. We hope that people will be on target with their questions, and we'll try to be brief. That way we can get in as many different folks as possible. But your input is welcome. If you are in Champaign, Urbana, here where we are, 333-9455 is the number. Toll free, no matter where you're listening, if it's a long distance call, use the toll free line. That's 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too. And the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Buchanan, hello.
Hello.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us today.
The pleasure.
We appreciate it. And I go into a conversation like this with slightly mixed feelings, a feeling of perhaps on the one hand that what new is there to be said on the subject, and the other, the feeling that this whole debate about spending, about taxation, about how big government should be, about how much debt is a problem, this is not going to go away.
Right.
And certainly it is likely to be the central issue, or certainly the one of the top issues in the presidential contest that we're headed into. So we'll still be, a year from now, we could still be talking about this.
I'm making a career out of this.
Well, it does certainly seem to be the case that many members of Congress, maybe all members of Congress, and certainly a lot of Americans, believe that the federal budget deficit, that is the fact that we spend more than we take in, is a big problem. And some people argue that to deal with that, we need to aggressively cut spending. So, though, let's take a step back and maybe talk a little bit more about the deficit and running deficits, and ask, well, is that a problem or not? How really do we think about that?
Okay, well, there are a couple of basic things that we need to get on the table first. One is just the difference between what a deficit is and what the debt is. Okay, the debt is the total amount of money that the federal government owes to anybody who's lent to it over the years at any given time. That's what the debt limit tries to set. So $14.3 trillion was the limit on that until this most recent deal was passed. A deficit is the annual difference between revenues and spending. And so basically the deficit each year increases the debt. If there's a surplus in a given year, it'll reduce the debt. Now, so that's just the mechanics of it. Right. The question is whether or not being in debt is a bad thing. And one of the most dangerous things that that people can get into when they talk about these issues, and I do it with great trepidation, is making analogies to the household. You know, the government should be run like a good household, or should be run like a good business, right? Because there are a lot of things about governments that are just fundamentally different about than households or businesses. But there are a few good analogies that we can draw out. And the most basic one to start the discussion is to say that there is not a single family in the world that has ever adopted a rule that says we will never, ever, ever go into debt no matter what, right? Because families know that there are times when either because things have turned unexpectedly bad temporarily, or there's a house that they want to buy, or the kids are ready to go to college, or for any of a number of other reasons, they realize it is a good idea, a sustainable idea. It is wise planning to take on debt. Similarly, there's not a single well-run business in the world that is not in debt. Even profitable companies are still in debt. In fact, there are entire sections of corporate management called debt management. The whole point is that a well-run company is going to figure out how to borrow money and use it most effectively in order to make the business grow. So the idea that being in debt is inherently a bad thing, which comes out of things like neither a borrower nor a lender be, you know, those types of old sayings, that idea is wrong at the household level, it's wrong at the business level, and it's certainly wrong at the governmental level.
Well, certainly there is one important difference between the U.S. government and your family, my family, and any business you could pick, and that is the government gets to print money.
Right.
So then perhaps, though, there's still the question about is there a level of overspending or a level of debt that is reckless?
Yes.
that we should not exceed.
Yes. And that's the important thing. That you notice that when politicians talk today, they talk about balancing the budget or paying down the debt. And the thing is that if you look at even the most basic uncontroversial economics textbook, you'll find nothing in there that says that the debt should be zero, and in fact, nothing in there that even says that the annual deficit should be zero, right? So the question that you just asked is perhaps more subtle than some listeners might imagine, because we just changed the discussion from should we or should we not have a zero deficit every year, or should we not have any government debt at all, to when is too much. And the answer to that question is different for the federal government because of the ability to create money. But at some level, the analogy continues to carry over from the personal level and from the business level. So, for example, if a person says, should I add to my household's debt in order to go to Las Vegas and blow $250,000, that's not good financial planning, right? And so the same thing goes for businesses, right? So, you know, when a business's debt management people are trying to decide whether or not to responsibly increase the level of debt that the business takes on, one of the things that they take into account is how that money is going to be spent, and if what it is going to be spent on will end up increasing revenues in the long run for the company more than it will increase the cost. Well, that's basically what the federal government and every other level of government should be doing. And one of the things that I've written about a lot that is really amazing, and I'm by no means the only person to have noticed this, but I've sort of made it a sort of specialty, is that the federal government doesn't even pay close attention to put it in sort of colloquial terms. They're barely even noticing the difference between spending that creates long-term growth and spending that is just a matter of sort of current consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And so the long-term perspective gets very perverse when you listen to politicians, because they keep talking about it as if the only responsible thing to do is have the federal government run a balanced budget and or pay down the national debt entirely. when doing so would necessarily require the federal government to give up on these long-term investments that are such good long-term investments that, like a well-run business, we should be willing to borrow money at a relatively low interest rate, and interest rates are really low right now, in order to invest in something that has a much higher payoff in the future.
Yeah. In fact, you really one of the things that I looked at in trying to think about the conversation we were going to have was the paper that you wrote, and it was actually published last year, mm-hmm. but certainly applies to where we are now, a paper in which you made the argument that, in fact, cutting deficit spending actually can be a bad thing, particularly when the economy is in decline.
Right. And that's the other part of it, is that the discussion that I just laid out was leaving aside entirely the short-term picture and whether or not the economy is in decline. So the, you know, there are two parts of it here. One is to say what I just said a minute ago, which is just looking at it in terms of the long run. If you were running any organization, what you would want to look for is opportunities to borrow money and use that money to invest it in something that will give you a higher rate of return. That's true no matter whether you're in a recession or not in a recession. That's just good long-term management, right? But as you say, today's different, right? This is one of the worst, weakest economies that we've seen in generations now. And now we are in a situation where borrowing the money, it does not even need to be justified by a long-term high rate of return, because here the short-run rate of return is the difference between people having jobs and people not having jobs. And that's the part of the discussion among policymakers that I find the most distressing, because Democrats started to agree more and more with Republicans over the last 20 years, but especially over the last 2 or 3 years, on exactly the wrong response to a weak economy. Right? As you said in your introduction, The problem here is that it seems like people don't agree on anything in Washington anymore. And as you said, they do agree that there are large deficits, but that's a fact that there are large mm-hmm. deficits. The worst thing is that they agree that we should be getting rid of the deficits right away, and that would be absolutely the worst thing that we could possibly do. The Obama administration, in my opinion, did a lot of things wrong during the run-up to the most recent deal. But the one thing that I have to give them at least minimal credit for is that they tried to push the cuts, which were exactly what we shouldn't be doing over the next couple of years. But given that they unwisely accepted cuts, they at least tried to push them off as far into the future as we could, and the hope that by the time 2 or 3 or 4 years from now comes in and the cuts would take effect, then we would be in a position where the economy, where the rest of the economy could be picking up the slack. But the problem is that right now, minimizing the cuts is better than maximizing the cuts, but we shouldn't be cutting at all. What we should be, because every time we cut a dollar of government spending today, whether it's at the local level, the state level, or the federal level, people like to think of budget cuts as just being numbers on balance sheets, and it looks better if you have if you've cut spending. But spending cuts means job losses, right? It really is that simple. When the federal government says, "Oh, we can't afford to support the state of Illinois the way that we usually do," because the federal government in every country in the world, and certainly in the United States, would have a history of stepping in and helping states that are in fiscal distress, as almost every state is today, right? So, you know, I know that Illinois has a particularly bad fiscal problem, and in a well-run government, what we should be saying is, okay, Illinois is not in a position to run deficits, but the federal government is. And the federal government should be the one that steps in and says, okay, Illinois, we know that if we don't help you, you're going to be laying off teachers, you're going to be laying off firefighters, you're going to be laying off public servants of all kinds. And then those people are going to turn around and not be able to buy as many clothes for their kids to go back to school. They're not going to. They're going to get their houses foreclosed on, and all those things are just going to make matters worse. So when the federal government says, "Oh, sorry, we're tapped out," then that makes matters worse. And the fact is, we are not tapped out. The rest of the world is dying to lend us money, and we should let them. Right, it is a good idea to borrow money at 1% interest when you have 15 million people looking for work, and that's unfortunately the situation that we're in right now.
Hmm. Let me just very quickly here introduce again the guest for this hour of focus, Neil Buchanan. He is professor of law at the George Washington University Law School and is interested in things like tax law, tax policy, law and economics. Has done a lot of writing about tax and spending patterns of the federal government, focusing on issues like deficits and the national debt. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to talk a little bit more about the debt, the big controversy of this past summer, I mean, certainly it did involve spending and how much the government spends and what the government spends money on.
Right.
But the big thing, the looming crisis that was looming and looming and looming until we finally got a deal, had to do with the limits placed on debt. And
Yes. So
the basic thing, again, as I understand it, well, you know, that we have year after year we're spending more than we're taking in, we got to account for that somehow. So we finance the deficit with debt. That is, we go out into the world, we borrow money. We say to people, if you lend us money, we'll pay it back to you with some interest. And
Right. The
crisis involved the fact that there is a limit on how much debt there can be, and Congress had to raise it. So the big fight was, well, okay, what are we going to do in addition to that? And the debt ceiling was indeed raised after agreement was reached to cut future spending. And,
right.
and we've now set up a bipartisan committee to talk about what we're going to do and so forth and so on.
Right.
But that so, but I don't know if I recall anybody really raising this, what seems to me kind of a fundamental question of, well, why do you have a debt ceiling at all? I mean, what
Right. Exactly
is the purpose of that?
Yeah, I'm equally lost on that one. It seems to be a historical artifact. It came up in the early part of the 20th century. Nobody quite understands why. And it was one of those things where once it existed, you can imagine how difficult it is for a member of Congress to say, okay, I'm going to vote to eliminate the debt limit. Because just as a rhetorical matter, it looks like what that's saying is, all bets are off. I've just voted to allow the federal government to borrow an infinite amount of money. Right? That's absolutely not what was going on, but that's the visual that people would get from this. So instead what happened was, rather than just eliminating it entirely, Congress on a regular basis would just raise it. And the reason they could do so on a regular basis without much thought on it was that everybody knew that that law, as you intuited, right? You know, that law doesn't do anything important. Because the amount of debt that we're going to take on is determined by the difference between how much we spend and how much we tax. And every year, Congress has to pass laws that determine that. So every year, Congress already goes through an exercise in which they decide how much the debt is going to be. And it's finite, right? You know, what they say is, this is how much revenue we're going to collect, and this is how much spending we're going to do, and the difference is going to be this amount of money. That's the deficit, and that will be added on to the debt. And we pass that budget in the belief that that's the, within the constraints of politics, that that's the right combination of taxing and spending. And so for the when the debt limit comes along, and people say, oh, look, the budget that you just passed implies that the national debt has to go up by, say, $500 billion, and the debt limit only has $200 billion left on it, then you would say, okay, well, obviously we have to raise the debt limit. And this year was the first time ever that anybody decided to use the debt limit for a political end. And this is entirely political. This was not a matter of $14.3 trillion being some magic number, you know, some percentage of GDP or you know, anything tied to anything real. This was entirely a matter of basically as part of this year's budget, which this Congress voted on, right, this past spring, that implied that federal borrowing was going to exceed $14.3 trillion, but they didn't include that increase in the debt ceiling as part of the process, even though they knew it was coming. I mean, it was just totally irresponsible on everybody's part. But then August comes along, and we're left saying, okay, we have already had the vote on how much the deficit will be and then how much the debt will go up. And now we have this debt ceiling that is just sitting there. And what do we do? And so people like me were saying, were pointing out that the president, as, not as the political leader of his party or even as the head of government, but as the head of the executive branch of government, right? The executive branch is supposed to execute the laws that the Congress passes. And so as the executive, the president was put in a position where he was being told by Congress, okay, here's the amount of taxes that you are supposed to collect. Here's the amount of spending that you are supposed to do. And here's the amount of debt that you're allowed to go to take on. And the three things couldn't all be done at the same time. There was no way to square that circle. And so it was odd that the assumption on almost everybody's part was, oh, well, if we hadn't had a deal by August 2nd, the only one of those three things that the president could violate was the spending side, right? Because Congress said, you shall do this spending. That's one of the laws that the president is supposed to execute. And so for the president to come along and say, okay, well, I'm not going to do that spending, would be to violate his oath of office, right? And so I found it ironic that the people who, from the president's right, who were screaming, for example, Representative Bachman was saying that President Obama should be impeached if he tried to borrow more money in excess of the debt limit, right? But the thing is, he could have been impeached for anything that he did, because the laws that he was being told to execute could not all be done at the same time. So the craziness of the summer was based entirely on this weird artifact of a law that serves no purpose and has never served any purpose other than occasionally giving people a reason to make speeches about the irresponsibility of the federal government, that was suddenly being used as a bludgeon to revisit the budget process that we had just so painfully gone through a couple of months before.
We have some callers to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. They've been patient here. We'll go first to someone who is in Coles County on our toll-free line. Line 4, right here. Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to say that, in theory, I think I agree with pretty much everything that you've said today. But this whole situation is really a catch-22 for the Democratic Party and for Obama.
Yes.
Because you've mentioned, well, you probably already know, but I'll go through it. You've mentioned that it was good that the budget cuts were put off until later.
Yep.
And, of course, that's good for the American economy, but it could be disastrous for the Democratic Party. And you probably know what I'm going to say, but I'll go through it here briefly. Obviously, if you get to the 2012 election, and there have been very few cuts in the safety net and many other programs at that time, there are going to be a lot of people say, well, the Republicans made these huge cuts we heard in the paper, and I haven't been hurt by them. I haven't seen any big problems from it. Maybe the Republicans have a good point. And so it's a catch-22. I think the only way for the Democrats to really win big is massive cuts in all kinds of entitlements and many other programs, everything you can imagine. And I'm not in favor of that. I'm just saying that would be the best chance of the Democrats winning big in the election. But it also would be bad probably for the American economy, as you have pointed out.
Right.
So it is a catch-22. I just thought I would mention that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead. No, I appreciate that. I hadn't thought of the sort of interesting twist on politics that the caller made about if people already think that massive cuts are on the way and yet they don't actually see them or feel them, then they might be led to believe that we actually have experienced massive cuts, and it turns out that nothing bad happened.
Yeah.
As I say, that's a brand new point to me, and I think it's absolutely correct. I think it's part of the broader issue, is why are the Democrats in such a corner? As I said earlier, it's really been over the last 20 years or so that the debate about deficits reached the point where the Democrats even felt that they had to agree to cuts this year, because it really had reached the point where you almost cannot say in Washington what I said in the title of it to the paper that the host talked about earlier, right? You know, is it sometimes good to run deficits, right? You get laughed out of town if you say something like that. But why? You know, this was not true 20 years ago, right? It's only been over the last 20 years, during a time period in which we ran huge surpluses for a while. Right. And now the deficits that we're looking at are to a very large extent transitory. Right. I mean, there are long-term budget issues that we need to worry about. But most of the short of the current situation is entirely a matter of the Great Recession. Part of this is because I'm an academic, I can just look back in history and say, well, wouldn't it be nice if we had done this, or wouldn't it be nice if we had done that? But I do look at it and I say, why do Democrats keep digging the hole deeper? Why do they keep agreeing that budget cuts are a good thing and spending cuts are a good thing, and that basically agreeing with Ronald Reagan that government isn't the solution to the problem, government is the problem? Because every time a Democrat agrees with any part of that, it just reinforces the narrative that puts us in the situation where people are saying, oh, okay, the only thing we can possibly do is exactly the thing that the caller says will really harm the economy. And we're now in the perverse situation where perhaps he's right. Perhaps the only way to shake people out of this is for things to get really bad. I worry about that, because when things get really bad, people start doing crazy, scary things. But the Democrats really might have painted themselves into that kind of a corner.
Hmm. Yes, I agree 100%.
All right. Well,
we're in for a very scary time, it looks like.
It does look that way, doesn't it?
Yes.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. I have somebody else here we can get to in just a moment. I hope they won't mind waiting just a moment longer. We're talking this morning in this hour of our show with Neil Buchanan. He's professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. This is Focus. We'll have more after a short break.
On the next Fresh Air, the life of a major league catcher. It's a position that's both physically punishing and intellectually demanding. Brad Ausmus is an Ivy League grad who spent 17 years behind the plate. He'll tell us which foul tips really hurt, what he'd say to a struggling pitcher on a visit to the mound, and how he'd prepare for a collision at the plate. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. More information is available at krannertcenter.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here during the week, Monday through Friday, 10 until noon, 10 different topics tomorrow morning. In the 10 o'clock hour, our monthly show on personal finance. We've been doing this for a long time. The guest is David Sino. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I, and it's a show that's designed to try to help you with your own decisions that you make on your own personal finance and investing. So you can call in and talk with Dave. Then also tomorrow, hour two, the 11 o'clock hour, the guest is journalist Douglas Waller, and we will be talking about a biography that he's written of Wild Bill Donovan, the man who was the head of the Office of Strategic Services during World War II. That was America's foreign intelligence organization at the time and was the precursor organization to the CIA. He's authored this new book. The subtitle is The Spy Master Who Created the OSS and Modern American Espionage. If you'd like to check out the schedule or listen to past programs, go to our website, will.com. illinois.edu. The guest in this hour of the program is Neil Buchanan. He's professor of law at George Washington University Law School, teaches tax policy, law, and economics. And we're talking about the issues of deficit debt that have been so crucial in politics here in the United States last summer and will continue to be as we go into the further into the presidential election season. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have someone on a cell phone here, and we'll go right there. Line two. Hello.
Yes. What I'm just baffled by is that there seems to be no discussion about the history of, you know, what's gone on. The fact that we were running a surplus, you know, when Clinton left office before the Bush tax cuts. And the thing is, we are at war right now. And when you look at the level that the taxes have been on the highest wage earners during war, I mean, it has been from 70 at a minimum to up to 94%. And it just seems to me it would not be difficult to get through to the American people and the wealthy that, you know, this is what you do when you're at war. You pay for it. And we have borrowed that money. And there seems to be no discussion about the war and no discussion of the history of what our tax rates have been. I don't understand that.
Yeah, I don't understand it either. I completely agree with the premise of the question. And the one thing I should point out is, which is very much supportive of that point of view that was expressed, is that during a weak economy, if you do believe that you need to reduce your deficit, then the one and only responsible place that you should turn is to wealthy taxpayers. Right, because cutting spending, as I said earlier, puts people out of work. Right, raising taxes on non-wealthy people puts people out of work. Right, because essentially what happens is people who are lucky enough to have incomes, if they have to pay higher income taxes, they end up spending less money on the groceries and all those things that I talked about. It's the highest income people, like Warren Buffett, who had that now famous op-ed in the New York Times a couple of days ago, saying that the federal government should stop coddling the wealthy. Now, as the caller points out, it's especially poignant that we're refusing to do this while we're fighting two or is it three wars, because we have always paid for wars by asking people to contribute, and especially asking the most wealthy people to contribute. And I should point out, even in non-war time, or at least less obviously wartime, because it's sort of hard to describe how much of the 50s and 60s were not wartime, depending on what you call a war. But during the greatest prosperity of the post-war period is when income taxes on the highest earners were in the range that the caller talked about, in the 70% range, even as high as 90% in the 50s. And those rates, now again, remember, those are the marginal rates, which means only on the last dollar earned by the highest income people, right? So it's not like the average pipe fitter was paying a 90% rate in 1955, right? So, you know, most people have relatively modest income tax rates, but the highest income people had really high rates. Translated to current dollars, these rates would kick in at over $500,000 or $1 million or even $5 million annual incomes. And if we look at the history of our economy during that time, not only did that not kill jobs, to use the favorite term of today, that was one of the great booms of this country's history. In fact, probably the greatest boom we've ever seen, at least coincided with and wasn't prevented by high tax rates. And so, you know, as the caller says, during war is an especially good time to think of it, but any time when you're thinking about what the country is and what it provides to people, the wealthiest, as Mr. Buffett points out, have gained an awful lot from the promise of America, and high tax rates on those high incomes get them to give back more than they would otherwise give.
Yeah, I just don't understand why they do not discuss this at all.
I have to say, but before the break, I was saying that I didn't understand how the Democrats sort of got themselves into this corner. And it has been a long-running process, but I do think that there's a lot of current blame. I mean, for example, President Obama, in his State of the Union address in January 2010, so roughly a year and a half ago, didn't talk about jobs and talked about deficits. Right, that was his choice. That wasn't something that he was pushed into. That wasn't something where, you know, somebody was holding the debt ceiling over his head. Right, that was entirely a matter of, you know, a political decision on the part of Democrats to say, okay, what we're going to do is play on the Republicans' playing field, right, and essentially say we want the deficit to go down. And yet, somehow, we're not going to ask the highest income people to help make the deficit go down. So, to me, the biggest political mistakes have been made in the last couple of years, and they've been entirely a matter of, as the caller asks, not talking about the things that actually are the important parts of our problems.
Well, again, I hope the caller will forgive me for jumping in here. I have somebody else I'd like to include, and we're now getting into about our last 15 minutes, and I'd like to invite some other callers as well. So 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and also email as possibility, will-talk at illinois.edu, and we will go on. And I believe that the next caller we have here should be in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm not sure, perhaps you've already covered the matter of income distribution, but it seems to me this is perhaps the most pressing question of all. We're now at a point where the income distribution is more unequal than it has been at any time since the late 1920s.
Yes,
and to me, this is much of the problem with the current recession, depression, whichever you care to call it. I don't see any means of rectifying this except very high taxes on the upper marginal portion of the income. We have a situation in our corporations. They're no longer privately owned. They're publicly stock-owned. And supposedly the boards of directors will act to keep salaries within a reasonable limit. But, of course, the board of directors of one company are the officers of another company, where the first company's officers are the board of directors, mm-hmm. and they're not going to do anything to hold salaries down.
Right.
Therefore, it doesn't act for the interest of the company. The companies are entirely short-term planning so that they can maximize salaries for these people who are running them, but in many cases probably have very little investment in the company.
Right. Well, this is a really important point because, as we were talking about a minute ago, the broader issue is whether we can, who we can collect money from if we think we need to collect money. And as this caller points out, there is a complete disconnect between this idea that salaries reflect maybe not what you're worth in some intrinsic sense, but at least what you're worth in the sense of what the market will bear. And as the caller points out, this is no market, right? This is just a rigged game. And so the idea that you get these people in financial companies who are making, you know, multi-million dollar bonuses and multi-million dollar base salaries and golden parachutes and all that kind of thing, and that you can't tax them, the argument goes, because that's a job-killing measure, has never made any sense to me. In fact, I guess it was 2.5 years ago, there was some discussion of no, I'm sorry, it was only 1.5 years ago. It was right after President Obama took office. There was some discussion in Britain about putting a tax on financial workers, the highly paid financial workers. And I wrote an op-ed in favor of that here in the United States, and the op-ed was published at CNN.com, which, you know, is fairly widely read. And one of the interesting things about writing op-eds is that you never quite know who's reading them, and you don't quite know how many people are reading them. But within hours, if not actually minutes, I received this flood of angry emails from people who work on Wall Street, who had read the CNN.com opinion piece. And they were absolutely up in arms. How dare I tell them that they don't that they don't deserve every penny that they get? How dare I say that the government should take away their hard-earned money? You know, which I actually just found amusing, because I thought to myself, well, if you're really out earning all that money, you shouldn't be wasting your time sending angry emails to law professors at George Washington University. But apparently they were on their break. But the broader point is that there is an awful lot of high end distribution, money being spent at the high end that maldistributes resources. PBS did something a couple of days ago that showed that the maldistribution of resources, of incomes and wealth in the United States, is as bad here as it is in China, which we think of as this sort of, you know, utterly dysfunctional, you know, crazy, klepto capitalist country that, you know, hasn't really matured into a modern capitalistic society. At least, you know, that's the caricature that people have often have of China. And the fact is that the United States, because of our distorted financial sector and these excessive payments. But more broadly, just because of the political culture, we will not challenge this complete distortion of who receives what and how many people remain in poverty while other people are spending millions of dollars on parties for their kids.
May I make one more comment?
If you can be quick, because I do have somebody else I want to get to. Yes.
The situation in China is actually better than it is here, because those very poorly paid Chinese are farmers, subsistence farmers, and therefore they can grow their own food. The very poorly paid people here might starve. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's go to another caller here. Indicator, line 3. Hello.
Yes, I got a couple of comments. First off, another argument for taxing the rich. You watch any business program on TV, Nightly Business Report, whatever, they're always saying, invest in China, invest in India, et cetera. So all these wealthy people, you think they're investing in this country? Heck no. They're sending their money to China and India. In fact, GE just exported I don't know how many jobs over to China, just announced that this week. Second, we are living in a new paradigm. We've, you know, the people are using their houses as ATMs. We are not in a recession. I argue that we're in a new normal. And I don't see how we're ever going to dig ourselves out of this unless we shift our priorities and stop funding the military and start funding things that are more that will build this country instead of just squandering it away. So I'll sit back and listen to your comments. Thanks.
I appreciate that. I'll pick up on the last comment about the new normal, and I fear that the caller is right. One of the worst things that I've seen in commentary on the economy lately has been a sort of opportunistic attempt on the part of those who oppose helping the people who really need help to say, to sort of grab onto this new normal in a really cynical way and essentially say, well, look, you've got all these people who haven't worked for a couple of years, and we've been begrudgingly extending their unemployment benefits, except that we haven't, right? There are a lot of people who have actually just completely fallen off the cliff here. And those people, I mean, one of the things that economists do know is that when people stop working, they quickly lose skills, they quickly lose habits, and even more importantly, they get employers don't want to touch people who have been out of work for a while because of this fear that there must be something wrong with them. And so the longer a person is not working, perversely, the harder it is for that person to start to work again. And so there are people who are saying, well, we shouldn't try to start a new stimulus program or try to start another jobs program, because in fact the new normal unemployment rate won't be the 4.5% that we experienced 10 years ago, or even the 6% that we experienced in the 80s and early 90s. Maybe the best we can do is get it down to 8%. And to me, that's just morally repugnant, because the whole idea there is, well, the longer we wait to help people, the harder it is to help them, and therefore the more we should just be willing to give up on them. And unfortunately, I do see a real possibility of that happening. And then over time, actually, for an even more perverse reason, the unemployment rate will go down. And that's only because these desperate people will... many of them, unfortunately, die, and those who don't will drop off the grid entirely and will no longer be counted in the unemployment statistics. But it will be a huge human tragedy, and much less important, but still important, an economic tragedy as well.
We're coming to the point here. We just have about 5 minutes. I want to thank the previous caller. I want to come back to something we talked about a little bit in the earlier in our conversation, and I mentioned the paper that you had written about deficits, and one of the things that you argue in the paper is that one of the problems that we have with the way that we think about deficits is that we fail to distinguish between spending that provides long-term benefits and spending that doesn't.
Right.
So how, though, do you wonder why does it seem to be so difficult to make the argument that something like, and I'll pick an example where you and I both have a self-interest, where, say, investing money in higher education, in colleges and universities, you know, why is it so difficult that even if you have to go into debt to do that, I'm not talking about students acquiring debt, I'm talking about the nation acquiring debt.
Right.
Why is it so hard to make the argument that if you have to borrow money to do that, that's a good thing?
Yeah, first of all, let me say I'm just delighted that you read my paper. but no, quite seriously, academics sometimes worry about it, as I'm sure you know, that we write these papers and nobody ever
reads. I wonder, does anybody ever read them? Yeah.
Right. But to take the point, I am probably more mystified than you are, even though I study this on a regular basis. You know, in my years as an economist and then transitioning into being a law professor, the one thing I just do not get is this inability of people to make the connection between borrowing for something that has a worthwhile long run rate of return and higher education. It's astonishing to me, especially when you consider, just in broad strokes, you know, sort of what made America become a great nation. Right. I mean, if you sort of think about, you know, the American century and all that kind of thing, the one thing that you know, as I entered higher education in the 80s, I mean, as a late 70s as a college student, and then into the 80s as my career got going, the one thing that I saw over and over again was even the foreign universities that were thought of as great, you know, Cambridge, Oxford, the Sorbonne, you know, the Heidelberg, the great universities that we've heard of, just didn't stack up. I mean, they're great. It's not like they're nothing, but they just didn't stack up to our great universities. Not just the Ivy League, but you know, the public Ivies, right? The University of Michigan, you know, the University of North Carolina, University of Illinois, several of the University of California campuses. And this is not a coincidence that America became great while its universities became the envy of the world. And what we've been seeing over the last couple of years, and especially in the last year, the thing that has scared me the most is this flurry of articles that are essentially trying to convince people that college isn't worth it, even at the individual level. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, I mean, to me, this is just a recipe for the end of greatness. I know I'm not answering your question, because I can't. I do not know why people don't see this.
Yeah. Well, I do. This is very interesting. Actually, I will soon. Yeah, I occasionally have the opportunity to talk with our president, and that's going to happen again soon. I mean, of our university, and mm-hmm. this very thing is something that I find fascinating. This effort to, you know, in secondary and elementary education, the big buzzword for such a long time has been accountability. Well, there seem to be people who want to extend that to higher education, as if the, you know, what they need to do is before you get your bachelor's degree, you have to take a test to show that you've learn something,
right,
to justify the public investment in the institution. I think that's kind of odd, but that seems to be where we're heading.
Well, to me, we're also heading in the direction of trying to describe professors as lazy and worthless. And it's easy to do that when you just do simplistic things like say, oh, well, what's a full-time teaching load at the U of I? And it turns out that because U of I is a really top-notch research university, there are plenty of professors who teach three courses over the course of a year, or four courses over the course of a year. And if you add up the number of hours that they're actually in a classroom, boy, does it look like a sweet lifestyle. But, you know, my father was a minister when I was a kid, and, you know, some people said, boy, what a great job. He works 1 hour a week. you know, and it used to be that this sort of tension with university professors, you know, sort of seeming not to work, was controlled by the idea that, but we understand that they really do work and that we're getting something important out of our universities. And earlier in the program, I said one of the worst things about making things really bad is that people start doing crazy, scary, stupid things. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the crazy, scary, stupid things that people do when they start looking at the budget and saying, oh, deficits, deficits, is they just start looking for places to cut, and they stop thinking about the wisdom or lack of wisdom of doing so. And we could lose our great universities because of that.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to say, I've really enjoyed talking to you. I'm sorry to say we're at the point we're going to have to stop. You have escaped having to give a thumbnail sketch of the 14th Amendment, at which I was going to ask you about it, that was somehow invoked as a short circuit of the problem with raising the debt ceiling. But that we'll have to let that one go and just say I really appreciate you giving us some of your time today. We thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our guest, Neil Buchanan, he is professor of law at the George Washington University Law School.
1 hour a week. you know, and it used to be that this sort of tension with university professors, you know, sort of seeming not to work, was controlled by the idea that, but we understand that they really do work and that we're getting something important out of our universities. And earlier in the program, I said one of the worst things about making things really bad is that people start doing crazy, scary, stupid things. I mean, one of the crazy, scary, stupid things that people do when they start looking at the budget and saying, oh, deficits, deficits, is they just start looking for places to cut, and they stop thinking about the wisdom or lack of wisdom of doing so. And we could lose our great universities because of that.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to say, I've really enjoyed talking to you. I'm sorry to say we're at the point we're going to have to stop. You have escaped having to give a thumbnail sketch of the 14th Amendment, at which I was going to ask you about it, that was somehow invoked as a short circuit of the problem with raising the debt ceiling. But that we'll have to let that one go and just say I really appreciate you giving us some of your time today. We thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our guest, Neil Buchanan, he is professor of law at the George Washington University Law School.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
Just like to remind you that indeed next week on Tuesday evening, I will have a chance to sit down once again and have an extended conversation with the president of the University of Illinois, Michael Hogan. He's been here for a little more than a year, and we'll have the opportunity to talk about some of the challenges of his first year and also to take questions. This will be a live broadcast on WILL-TV, also AM and online. This will be Tuesday, August 23rd at 9 p.m. So we hope you can tune in, and we'll be taking calls. And if you'd like to submit some questions in advance, you can do that too by writing to our email site. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And that is it for this morning on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Much more in the way of news and features, other things coming up as part of the afternoon magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu.
edu. Let's take a look at commodity prices now. A lot of red on the screen late this morning, this Thursday morning. September wheat in Kansas City trending at 804, down 19 and a quarter. December 827 and a half, down 19 and a half. September wheat Chicago, 713 and three quarters, down 13 and three quarters. December, 744 and three quarters, down 13 and a quarter. September corn, 701 and three quarters, down 9 and three quarters. December, 715, down 10 and a half. March, 728, down 10 and a half. May, 731 and a half, down 11 and a quarter. September soybeans, 1353 and three quarters, down 3. November, 1363 and a half, down 3 and a quarter. January, 1374, down 3 and three quarters. March, 1378 and a half, down 4 and three quarters. September meal unchanged at 354.50. September soybean oil, 55.19, down 46. August live cattle, 114.35, down 150. October, 115.50, down 190. September feeder cattle, 133.50, down 192.5. October lean hogs, 87.05, down 35. September crude oil, 83.22, that's down 4.36. The U.S. dollar, 74.25, up 58. The CI